Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Well, I talked to one of the pioneers in action sports, Travis Pastrana. Amazing interview, I'll say. Really thoughtful guy who, considering what he does on a motorcycle and beyond. So that's a really strong interview, and good sports coming up after that. First, I'll tell you about JB Weld DIY projects. You want to get through those? Sure. You want to save money? Yeah. You want to avoid paying the repairman? Big or small repairs, home or garage, ordinary household glue. Well, starts with the word ordinary. You don't want that. You don't want ordinary anything. There's a better choice. There's JB Weld. Proud to have JB Weld on as a sponsor. These guys are good guys. I know the owner. I've hung out with these guys in their booth at SEMA, and we started talking, and it was very organic. A love was found between the two of us, and adhesives. DIYers, I should say, have trusted JB Weld for over 50 years, proudly made in the USA. You keep them in your toolbox, you keep JB Weld in your kitchen drawer, your craft room, and it'll work on metal, wood, plastic, and more. Don't glue it, JB Weld it. Available at jbweld.com, Home Depot, Lowe's, AutoZone, Advance Auto Parts, O'Reilly, Walmart, Amazon, Michaels, and more.
Even people who disagree on everything agree on Adam Carolla's I'm Your Emotional Support Animal. Tucker Carlson says, as the revolution reaches its final, most humorless stage, there's no better, braver, or more insightful observer than Adam Carolla. You may feel despondent about what's happening right now. This book will remind you that you should also be amused. Pick up a copy now at adamcarolla.com.
Travis Pastrana has joined us. Travis is 36 years young. God, I feel like I've known your name for 20 years now. The TV show Life Size Toys, it premieres this Monday, July 6th on Quibi. And I'll tell you about it in a second because I watched it last night. So great job, Travis, and thanks for joining us.
Dude, thanks a lot for having me on. I appreciate it.
I'm a big fan of yours because I like people that have a good relationship with fear. And I think you have a very possibly too healthy a relationship with fear, but I'm worried that a lot of people around me are freaking out because of this whole pandemic, and I don't really care, but I think I have a good relationship with fear. I'm guessing you're not freaked out about COVID-19 either because of your relationship with fear, but you tell me.
No, I mean, life is a calculated risk, and definitely my mother-in-law, she was out here when, you know, everything kind of stopped, the world stopped, if you will, and you know, definitely doing my best to try to be proactive in washing hands and everything like that. But, you know, at the same time, it's tough, you know, being the touring and like, you know, live action sport has come. I mean, the world came to a stop, but live action sport has definitely come to a stop. And even as we're starting to get going again, I mean, I got a rally race this next week, but my number one mechanic is from England and my co-driver is also from Europe. So I'll be doing that without those guys. So it's, you know, I guess I have faith that the powers that be are smarter than I am and they'll tell us what's going on. But definitely, you know, when it's your time, it's your time.
Does rally racing seem relatively calm and somewhat easy compared to all the stuff you're doing on two wheels?
No, actually kind of the contrary. I think racing, you push yourself the hardest. So rally, there's no safety barriers. You could be going 150 mile an hour with a 200 foot cliff on your outside in the snow at night, while it's raining, you know, so there's a lot of factors. It's kind of making the best of the worst. If you will, like even NASCAR, you know, you're not necessarily worried about dying per se, but still like you have to be so spot on and precise that the nerves and the adrenaline and actually take over more to trying to do the best that you can, as opposed to worrying about livelihood, I guess.
you have the daredevil gene, I guess. I'll just call it a gene. I had it too. It's the kids. It shows itself early because you have thoughts like, hey man, if we got up on the roof, I think we could clear the patio and make it into the pool. If we got a running start and jumped off the roof, like I think we could hit the deep end of the pool. We'd have to clear some of the patio first. But you start having those thoughts at an early age. Start, you know, as soon as you get a bike, you want to jump the bike. Is that how you started?
Oh, without a doubt. So my dad, he's one of six brothers in a family, and My grandfather was Golden Glove boxer. They were all Division I sports. My uncle actually played quarterback for Denver Broncos for a couple of years. So all my cousins were more athletic, stronger than I was. Got beat up all the time as a kid. Realized that I was super durable, which worked out great. And that also I needed a motor because my legs weren't as strong as my peers. Or at least my family. So at the end of the day, I realized that when most people panic, that's when I came alive. I felt like when the world was perfect, I was just bored and not as good. But when you put everything on the line, when most people kind of back down, that's when my mind started working. That's when I started getting excited and actually engaging. So I feel like a lot of, you know, contact sports in general, like if you can slow down what's going on around you when things hit the fan, that's a quality you're going to need. I mean, even a quarterback, you look at football, he's got so much coming at him. He knows if he makes mistakes, he's going to get pummeled. But you have to make those decisions on a fly.
Yeah. Being able to slow things down. And being able to slow yourself down. Like when you get strapped into the car and you sit in the car for long periods of time, you know, oftentimes before the race or after. But you spend a lot of time in a six-way harness with a Hans device on and everything all strapped in and net up in the window, and you're sitting in a roll cage. And you could kind of – a lot of people would freak out. Like a lot of people would feel claustrophobic or like they couldn't breathe or something like that. But you probably – get into some, I don't know, is it like when a computer goes to a sleep mode or something where you just kind of go zen? Because I've done a lot of car racing, and I know what that feeling is of just sort of being almost, it's not like you're sleepy, but it's almost like you've turned your senses off because you're strapped in. You're almost overwhelmed how much you're strapped in.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Every time I see you get in the car and everything, and definitely it's a different experience. It's something that a lot of people don't like. My family, myself, I live for those moments when everything's on the line. And, you know, that's the difference between now, and I'm realizing more and more so, you know, with COVID and everything, we've been doing a lot of online racing. And it takes everyone to put them on a completely even playing field when you're doing sim racing, because there's no adrenaline. There's no consequence. So I feel like the world, when there's a consequence, like take rally, for example, there's a 200-foot cliff on the outside. You know that if you hold it wide open, you'll probably not go off that cliff, but most people will back it down a little more just because of the cliff, not because they don't think that they can stay inside of that at the fastest speed they can go. So it's making those commitments and understanding what your ability level is, not being crazy, but knowing what you're capable of and sticking with that. So when you're in a car, you have to understand, and it's tough now with all the safety, because it's actually made it more difficult and more crashes probably happen because, like you said, you're strapped in this car. It's usually 30 degrees warmer than outside. So if you're in a NASCAR and it's 100 degrees outside in Daytona on 4th of July weekend, it's 120, 130 degrees in the car. So you're sitting in a sauna, you're strapped in, you're in a suit that's basically like a sweatsuit. You can't move your neck, you can't move anything. You're going four wide at 200 miles an hour into a corner, and you can't see the car on either side of you, and you can't see over the tailgate of the car in front of you. And it's like that moment you kind of take a deep breath, and you're like, you look for there's a Sunoco sign. And as soon as you see that, you can't even tell when the corner's coming. You just turn the wheel, and right, Everyone's going to do the same thing. And if anyone makes a mistake, that's when it gets intense, because now all of a sudden everyone's fumbling and no one, you're listening to your spotter. So for me, like, the more stimulus there is, the more exciting the world becomes.
So Travis, for me, watching you do a backflip rooftop to rooftop in a couple buildings in LA, maybe 8 or 10 stories off the ground, although it's academic. If it's 3 stories or 25 stories, you don't make it, you don't make it. But that is one of the hairiest. There's 2 super hairy things I've seen, and I've been around since Evel Knievel. You doing the backflip rooftop to rooftop was completely and utterly insane. And whoever the fella was who jumped the bike in Vegas and landed on top of
Matto, Arc de Triomphe, New Year's No Limits, that was awesome.
The hairiest,
coming back down.
Coming back down was the hairiest part. It wasn't going up, it was coming down that seemed totally insane to me. Did that seem totally insane to you?
Yeah, Matto's 100%. Cause hey, look, if you're going up, you can usually get out of things and you're not falling as far. Going down, if he goes too far, which he went a little too far, his actually thumb bent completely around backwards. He went straight into surgery after that, even though he was able to pull it off. The risk is so high. But like, so I, you know, jumped out of a plane without a parachute and my friend met me on the way down. You do the thing roof to roof. But if you make a mistake, it's going to really suck anyway. So for me, adding what you're jumping over, it's kind of like they say the fawns jumping the shark. Like, yeah, it really doesn't matter what you're clearing. Like we hydroplane across lakes and rivers and stuff. And they're like, well, how deep was it? Like, right. I don't know. Your tire's only going down 2 inches. So, for me, I've always been able to kind of take that away. Look, if you come up short on a 100-foot jump, you're going to break both your wrists at the best. So does it really matter there's a 10-story drop? Yeah, I mean, you're going to break both your wrists. You're going to fall for a few seconds. You're going to die. So I understand that. But there's always risk. And if you know you can do it, then you can do it.
Do you, when you're doing something like that 10-story rooftop to rooftop, how far apart were the takeoff and the landing ramp?
So that was the part that made it difficult because your motorcycle can go approximately 85 feet in second gear. I'm not exactly sure what the speeds are on that, but the roof, when we got there, it was on an incline. So it was 8 degrees incline. So 8 degrees steeper for takeoff, 8 degrees steeper on the other side for landing, just for runoff, I guess.
Pitch. Yeah. For drainage. Right.
Right. So when I got there thinking I got to hit this in second gear, now I realize that all the training that I did had absolutely no effect or no bearing on how fast I had hit that jump. So that made that more difficult because now I had to shift up like on the way to the takeoff ramp, which if you hit neutral or miss your shift, you can't stop in time after that.
Right.
And if you miss it, then you don't have the speed to make it. So the shift actually made it very difficult.
So did you take off in second gear or third gear?
So it took off there in third gear. As you can see, I pulled. So I figure if you're going to crash, you might as well, it's going to hurt anyway. You might as well make it look good. So did a backflip with a, what they call a knack-knack on that one. But it was steeper than the takeoffs that I normally take off on. So I was over-rotating. And lucky I didn't blow off the back because probably would have shot right off the other building.
So if you're going to hit a ramp like that in second gear, then you would start in second gear.
That is correct. As you know, you can, with a dirt bike, you can usually start fairly good in second. Honestly, with the new 450s, if this was a little bit more modern, we probably could have just done the whole thing in third gear and they have a lot of torque.
Because they're thumpers. Are we talking about thumpers?
About thumpers.
Right.
They were called thumpers for their sound, and they always thumped you into the ground when they misfired. But now they're better.
Four strokes. Right.
Yes.
I had a Honda. I had a Honda 250 Elsinore. I had a red racer. I had a red racer Honda. Like the first kind of real dedicated sort of factory motocross bike was a Honda, had a plastic tank when they used to all have metal tanks. It had twin shocks in the back, but they would lay them down sort of. Not fond of the drum brake in the front, but a Honda Elsinore 250 red race. Max Pata, there is a picture of me doing a wheelie in the backyard of a house I rented in North Hollywood on that Honda Elsinore 250 red racer. So
you have no idea how happy this makes you right now. That is awesome. That's a good pull.
I'm going to show you a picture of me doing a wheelie in the backyard of my North Hollywood rented house in that thing. And I'll show you a picture of me jumping my BMX bike when I was 10, too, in my front yard of another.
Yes.
Are you seeing that?
No, that was that was the start of the Honda era. That was the beginning of when it used to be when men were men and bikes were crap. And that Honda Elsinore came out and said, man, this is a real machine. This is the closest thing to the modern day bike we had.
Yeah. I remember very clearly, and again, I'm older than you, but that back before there was monoshocks and disc brakes, right? So the front of this thing had a drum brake. And the drum had a little fork that came off the hub and it grabbed the cable where you could adjust the tension on the brake and then work the front brake. But the little forks broke off. And I could never weld them back on or fix it or do anything. So I never had a front brake. And we used to do a lot of hill climbing. And
you got to come back down.
And you got to come back down. And coming back down with no use of the front brake means just lock up the rear and fucking hang on. Like that, you're going to go flying down that hill. But yeah, you think, well, you don't want to grab the front brake hard, but if you have no front brake and you're going down that hill and your whole brake ballast, like everything is just shifted forward, it's hairy.
Yeah, no, that's some Days of or On Any Sunday type stuff with Malcolm Smith coming back down the hill when everyone else is walking.
Yeah, there's a picture, Max, of me jumping that thing like in the desert on top of someone's hill or something too. But anyway, look, I don't do 1/100th of what Travis does. But what I'm saying is I do understand that feeling of being on a bike and getting airborne. And in a weird way, I appreciate what you do. Well, there I am on my BMX bike when I'm 11. I appreciate.
I love that ramp. Sorry to interrupt, but the ramp is, I mean, look at that. It's rocks. It's 2x4s cut. Plywood takeoff, it looks like duct tape to the top. I mean, that is very, very, that's ingenious, really.
We did not have a lot of technology back then in North Hollywood in the 70s. But I totally understand what it's like to get on a 250 and get airborne. And that's why doing a somersault or a twin double backflip feels, or anything else you do on that bike, I think I appreciate it more than someone who's never been on a bike and never been in the air on a bike. I have that much more respect for it.
It's really funny when we take people out in cars and driving, and you take someone out that you would think would be really scared, but they have no real concept of speed or when you should brake. You take someone out that's a pretty good driver, and you put them passenger in a rally car with, you know, a rally cross car, maybe with 700 horsepower, 0 to 60 in 1.8 seconds. And you're coming up on the tree line and over a crest fully sideways. And those people know that they would have hit the brakes a long time before you're hitting the brakes with the kind of the technology we have and the all wheel drive. It's the people that understand their immediate danger that are actually more scared than the people that haven't experienced it. So it's awesome to hear that you've gone through all the same childhood experiences we have.
Well, I ate shit a thousand times, and I learned to kind of respect what guys like you do, but I also kind of learned to respect the pavement, you know, like you got to have a relationship. I wanted to have fun, but you didn't want to hit the pavement as many times as I did, but you had that gene, and that's where you were growing up. And at what age did you start to sort of think, maybe there's a path here? Like maybe there's a way I can get paid to do this?
The money never really thought about it, to be honest. I mean, every kid, you want to be an astronaut or a firefighter, bull rider. I always wanted to be a dirt bike racer. And, you know, we hit 10, 11, 12, 13. Most kids' realities kind of set in, for my parents, they were hoping that reality would set in, but it was keeping me in school with good grades, gave them some, carrot to dangle over me, if you will. My uncles, my dad had a Harley. He sold that. Family had a boat. We sold that. Ended up with two mortgages on the house. My uncles, who all work family construction, were basically taking pay cuts to pay for the fuel to get me to the races. And my dad said, "Hey, look, your Uncle Alan was the greatest athlete that's come out of Annapolis. He's quarterback for Broncos, and he still works at Anne Arundel Community College now. They call him Coach P, lacrosse and football. He teaches health class up there." I said, "You're never going to make a living doing what you love. But every day that you give it everything that you can, that you chase your dreams, that you love what you do, our whole family will support you in any way that we can." So for me, every single day that I've been able to do what I love to do, I've just tried to go until the wheels fall off. So it's never about the money. I made some horrible business decisions because I wanted to chase my heart. And I believe that's why I'm still in this sport now and still being able to make a living doing what I love to do, is because I always went with what I was passionate about, not necessarily what was the best business decision. Because at the end of the day, I'm making a living at a hobby. And that's something that you have to work really hard at, making a living at a hobby. it doesn't make a lot of sense, but there's so many people that want to do it. You better be passionate about it and willing to spend every second. People say, what do you do in your off time? I say, I ride dirt bikes and drive cars. Well, what do you do for fun? Ride dirt bikes and drive cars.
What do you do? So the process of coming up with a stunt, the process, do people come to you on your team? Do you sort of think about it and then go to them rooftop to rooftop or jumping out of an airplane with no parachute? Like, what's the genesis of the ideas? How does it work?
Everything is a little unique. For us, we decided very quickly when the Jackass guys helped us get the MTV show that if you're going to come up with an idea, you have to be at least willing to try that idea first. Because Knoxville was always like, let's get a bull. I'm like, what? Why? He's like, it's great. It's a win-win. I'm like, no, if the bull doesn't hit anyone, we won't air it because it's not good enough. And if the bull hits us, we're getting hit by a bull. That is a lose-lose. We have a very different understanding of that. So for us, it's about passion. People always say, oh, you push the guys. I'm like, no, guys that want to do stuff, that they go everywhere in the world. They ask everyone for help to learn a new trick or do something they see. If they want to do it, no matter where you are in the world, if it's action sports and it's big and you want to do it as safely as possible and you want people that can help you, you come to Nitro Circus and you say, okay, I want to do a quadruple backflip on a BMX bike. And we say, instead of saying no, we say, okay, what's your abilities? Have you done three? How can you over-rotate? What are the ramp angles? How high do you have to go? And you know, everyone says, oh, well, who builds your ramps? I'm like, no, we do. The riders do. We weld our own stuff. We build our own stuff. So many parents are always coming and saying, oh, if our kids had what you guys had. I'm like, man, most of these guys, Josh Sheehan, only rider to ever triple backflip a dirt bike. He worked in the mines as soon as he was out of high school, a trade. He didn't even finish really high school and went in and basically paid for his own way, built his own ramp, welded it, took it to the desert, and learned how to do a backflip. While I'm not recommending that route, the guys that make it in these sports put their heart and soul into it. And there's no amount of money worth putting your life on the line. But these stunts come not from someone director or anything. They come directly from the riders, because there's nothing that I could ever ask someone, hey, do you think you could try this? That's putting their life on the line now. So right. If they're going to put their life on the line, it's got to be their idea.
And the same for you.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of ideas that come through. And for instance, History Channel came to us with the Evel Knievel concept. Actually the Evel Knievel concept. They said, can you guys do a live stunt for us? And they said, it has to be something with history. And one of the guys, Dave Mateus, in the back of the room, raised his hand. He said, we're doing something with history, something that's going to show, our dad's generation, where action sports or where stuntmen have gone in action sports, and show the scooter generation where stunt came from with Evel Knievel and jumping cars and the showmanship. He's like, we have a chance to bring three generations together and really give tribute to the kind of the man that started it all. So with that, I raised my hand after I told my wife literally like a week before. I was like, I'm not going to do anything stupid anymore. I'm really going to tone it down, honey. I promise. And then that came up. I was like, well, if we have a chance to jump Caesar's Fountain, which we called up and they said yes right away. I'm like, wow, careful what you ask for. You just might get it. And this is going to be an opportunity to give tribute. I'm like, I don't care if it's not that it's going to be raining, but it's raining, bike overheats, whatever happens, crash the first jump. I'm like, it has to be someone that understands what Evel was about, and that it was about the showmanship and the building this thing up. And even if everything goes wrong, he always said, you're not a failure until you fail to get back up. I'm like, that person that does this, if everything goes wrong, they crash out that first jump, unless they're dead, they better get back on that bike and do the next jump. So for me, that was an awesome opportunity. Luckily, everything went well, but just to give tribute and to kind of bring those generations together, and actually ended up with the number one show on cable TV for the year. So for me, that was a huge honor, and kind of like everything else at Nitro, it starts from a small idea, and with everyone involved, usually it grows to whatever it ends up being.
As I recall, and I interviewed Evel Knievel shortly before he passed away, and it was funny, Evel's set in his ways, kind of a tough guy. And yeah. There's certain guys, it's funny, you're not wired this way, but there's certain guys, when you start talking to them about their business, they don't like it. You know, they go, no, let me tell you what's going on. And I was saying to him, evil, what the guy's doing today is pretty amazing, but they have a lot of travel in their suspension. You run a Harley with a steel tank and about 2.5 inches of travel, meaning the distance between the back fender and the top of the rear tire. You just didn't have the suspension. You didn't have the materials, you know? And he's like, what are you talking about? That Harley was the finest motorcycle ever built. And I was like, no, I know. But I'm saying the shit you were trying to do on essentially a street bike is insane. You know, he's like, that was a great bike. And I was like, all right, I'm trying to compliment you. But I get it. You, as I recall, had to do the Evel Knievel stunts on a bike that sort of mirrored or closely mirrored Evel's bike and not the highfalutin kind of double backflip, you know, 250s you're used to riding. Is that a true statement?
That is 100% true. And everyone was like, what'd you modify on it? I'm like, look, all we did was we added extra material to the back because like Evel, every time I landed, the bikes aren't meant to fly. You know, they're great bikes for flat tracking and everything. I think that whole movement of the older bike with a lot of horsepower is coming back, and the hooligan racing and everything, just, you know, fun racing on kind of older technology, if you will. But obviously the motors are better. The ramps, he had a wedge ramp, and it's the one thing that we did differently. You know, I wanted to make sure that I wasn't bouncing going off the lip. Evel, man, it didn't matter if he knew he was going to make it or wasn't going to make it, how bad the ramp was, how slow the bike was. He just went. And that's what people came to see. They came to see this guy that if he said he was going to do something, he was going to do it. And they could live vicariously through this man that was seemingly fearless and such a showman, always put on the show. So for me, I wanted to give tribute to the show. And man, I've never jumped in high heel boots before.
Oh,
I don't think I've ever worn high heel boots before, but I had a leather suit. It was 110 degrees in Vegas. I had high heel boots that sucked.
No.
I had 3 inches of suspension travel. And oh man, it was,
Yeah. I mean, Evel, that's the other thing. It's like Evel was wearing Beetle go-go boots on, I mean, it's insane what he did with how he did it. And if you watch his initial crash on, at Caesar's Palace, his landing ramp looks like a bunch of like 4x8s or something like put together and leaned over a van. Like, I mean, his landing ramps were like, I don't even know how he thought he was going to hit those landing ramps. And you said wedge versus something that was more progressive or something like that. Explain that.
So he took off on a takeoff that was between 15 and 20 degrees steep, but it went from 0 degrees to 15 degrees. There was no transition. So when you hit that, the bike with no suspension at, you know, 70, 80, 90 miles an hour, it compresses like you're hitting a wall and bounces. Well, Evel, his takeoff was only like 5 feet wide. His landing was maybe, you know, one wide sheet of 8 foot sheet of plywood. And you're thinking, man, if you're going up bouncing and sideways, how, like, you better have that absolutely perfect. And you saw one of the guys that tried to jump Caesars actually missed the landing, just mostly because the ramps just weren't that good. So yes, everyone's like, oh, you broke Evel's record. I'm like, no, we modernized it. Like, basically we're giving tribute to him, but he would have wanted to go as far as he could have pushed it. So did we go further? Yeah. But we went further because we have the technology to make it easier to go. You know, Evel's furthest jump was only 130 feet. At 14 years old, I jumped over 200. But the technology and the information, once you see someone do it, it becomes so much easier. So for me to go out there, and I think the longest jump that day was the Greyhound bus jump, which was 180 feet. And on a bike with no suspension, that's difficult. But we'd already been jumping a car, you know, over 250 feet, which has very limited suspension as well. So we know a lot more about how things fly. And between Red Bull and Nitro Circus, we got a really good idea of all the data on weights and physics and stuff that Evel didn't have access to.
Yeah, it's interesting. You talk about a sort of wedge ramp. So like he'd go straight ahead and then he'd hit the ramp, and the ramp just sort of, you'd bottom out as you hit the ramp because it wasn't progressive. You didn't, it's like, imagine, you know, you can skate a pool because one wall's vertical and the bottom's flat, and then it transitions. And that's how you skateboard a pool, but what if the wall just met the bottom? You know what I mean? Like, how could you? Yeah, how would that work? And yeah, I never really thought about that. I always looked at it as landing ramps, and I was like, God, that doesn't seem like a whole lot of width or technology there. So for you, and is there anything you're thinking about? Is there a holy grail of stunts? Is there something you've been thinking about trying and haven't tried yet? And then I'll back that out to when you are thinking the first time you think about doing a double backflip at X Games. Once that seed gets planted in your head, does it just stay there until you pull that thing off?
Now, this is not a great mentality, maybe, but I feel like if you know something is possible, especially being where action sports is my livelihood, like it's almost my job to see it come to fruition. Whether it's myself or now as I'm getting older, you know, it's helping somebody else learn from my mistakes and work on, you know, the ramp technology and the radiuses and the heights from there. But for me, the hardest trick that I ever did I did it the first time on a trampoline, a double backflip with a full twist, which is they call a half in, half out, basically, backflip 180, front flip 180. And I did that back in 99 or 2000. I did it first time in a foam pit on a bicycle in 2003, landed on a mountain bike for the first time in 2014. And then, 2 years ago in 2017, I was able to land it on a dirt bike. So that was the holy grail for me. And the last thing that I felt I needed to do. And my wife was so upset. She's like, look, you're out here, you're filming for a video project that you're definitely going to lose money on. And you've already spent so much time figuring this out and you could possibly die. Like what you're going, you know, 75 feet in the air, two flips and a full twist with this dirt bike. Why? And I said, because I've spent my whole life wondering if it's possible. And I have to know, I have to at least give it 110% effort and see what went wrong, what could have gone right. And, by fate or dumb luck or whatever you want to call it, was able to ride out of that. And, you know, no one's still done it to this day, which is pretty cool for me being how, like, I was kind of already retired, if you will, at that point. But that's what it is. Like you said, if you know something can be done. So if you go to X Games 2006, kind of what I'm known the most for, live TV, Staples Center, sold out crowd, all on their feet. Everyone was heard about this trick that at the time seemed impossible. And everyone thought if he misses it, he's going to die. My mom's crying on the side. Everyone's on their feet. Everyone from all the different sports are there. And time seemed to slow down. I was like, it's going to work. But what people don't know is I was trying to switch over to cars at the time. And I'm sitting second to Colin McRae, who is a rally legend, world champion. He comes over to the U.S. Now, U.S., I think we got the best drivers on earth with NASCAR and IndyCar. But it's not taken seriously between the world guys with F1 and everything. They just don't see the technical. But those guys are perfect. They're amazing drivers. So Colin comes over. I'm sitting second. That's where I want to go with my future. And here I am sitting third in this event for best trick. So I already have a medal if I don't even take my last run. And there's nothing really to gain. I mean, I can win this event, a couple thousand dollars. Great. But I have a chance to beat or at least race and finish with Colin McRae and go into rally cars. And that was my first time I was even close to leading a rally event. It's on this huge stage. And my best event was freestyle coming up. So it's like, all right, you've got everything to lose and nothing to gain. And I just thought about it. I thought, you know what? I can do it. Like I'm 8 for 10 in the foam pit. That's an 80% chance that this trick is going to work. Yeah, there's a 20% chance that I'm going to end up in the hospital, but I know I can make it. And I just had my rally team and my wife, girlfriend at the time and everything, just looking at me like, you're an idiot, but it worked.
Yeah.
You know it can, so you do it.
No, I know that it's a feeling. There's also kind of a feeling where you're leading up into it and it in one sort of millisecond, you have to commit to it. Like there's a version of it where you don't commit, where you just do one flip and kind of get out of it. Like there's a feeling where you go all in. There's like an all in past the point of no return kind of feeling that, again, I'm picturing from the stupid stuff I did on my BMX bike, like where you're trying to, I used to like to jump sets of stairs. You know, there'd be 12 stairs. there was a parking lot. So I know that I know exactly that feeling, which is there was a church that was across the street from Colfax Elementary, and it had like a set of 12 stairs, cement stairs with stucco walls about 5 foot wide on both sides of it. And I was never gutsy enough to jump the stairs on my BMX bike. And on sixth grade graduation, while everyone else was like wanted to get cake and hang out, whatever, I was like, now it's time to take on those stairs. And like, yeah. Now you're a man. You're out of the sixth grade. You're officially a man. And you've got to go conquer those stairs. Who have been haunting me for 3 years because I was too fucking scared to get a run at them and just go off them. And I remember while everyone else was like going, hey, we're going to have a barbecue. I was like, I got to go to the stairs. And I went across the street to the church and I went up top and I was like, now you're a man and now you have to conquer these stairs. And I just jumped it. I just ate shit. I remember hitting the stucco wall on one side and rolling on the ground and everything. But I remember like, you got to do those stairs. They're bugging you.
Now, yeah. My question to you is, would you have regretted more crashing, eating shit, or not having the guts to want to know if it would have worked?
Once I ate shit, I got up and I was like, all right, well, you did the stairs. You ate shit, yeah. But you did the stairs and you can move on. By the way, to the loading dock behind Gelson's supermarket, there was a 4 foot high cement loading dock. That was like, I can do that loading dock too. It's the same stupid shit. But I mean, yes, I was bothered by it. And this is a much smaller scale than what you're doing. I'm saying it's the same feeling. I think is what I'm talking about.
It doesn't change from your first time you get air, jumping a 5 foot tabletop or jumping literally a 400 foot double, over the Grand Canyon. It's pushing yourself and knowing that if you can do it, you're like this, I need to become a man. And you test yourself. You're like, especially my dad always said, if you say you're going to do it, do it. So be careful what you say you're going to do, but be a man of your word. And I feel like he might've got that from Evel Knievel. Just like if you think you can do it, don't talk about it. Don't brag about it. Be it. And that was, for me, like listening to that story, that's what I feel like my childhood. So many times you think of something and instead of saying, hey, I'm going to go do this, you just get up and you're like, I know I can do it. And you might be wrong. You might be right. But at the end of the day that, you had the guts to try it. And I feel like not being afraid to fail and also being accountable for your actions, like in action sports, when you crash, you are fully accountable for your decision. Like it's going to suck. You're going to get broken. You're going to get hurt. And I feel like those are life lessons that really followed me through for everything I've ever done.
I think we might have your trick here. Chris went and found it. And tell me if this is it.
Come down and stay. On the 8 foot tall takeoff.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. What a stuck landing on that. Yeah, that was, I've never seen anyone do that on a motorcycle or really
still
anything.
Haven't yet. So this is, they call it resi. It's hard plastic over basically like a 3 foot tall bag. So technically to be official, you got to do it to dirt, but I was just stoked. I wanted to prove that this could be done. Everyone's like, it won't go into the second rotation. I'm like, what
right.
do you mean? Like
crazy.
Every time I over-rotate the one, because I was trying to do a backflip 360 for 6 years. And just the way it came through, it didn't work. But I'm like, what if you add another rotation? So it's easier to do a double backflip with a 360 than a single backflip with a 360. Now that'll boggle everyone's mind, but it is a fact.
How much are you, not in what you just did, but let's just say you're just getting big air on a jump, sort of indoor, stadium style motocross riding, Jeremy McGrath style stuff. How much controlling of a bike can you do with the gyroscopic action of the rear wheel, whether you're accelerating or braking?
So the faster the wheels are spinning, the more it matters. So for instance, in a car, if you hit the handbrake, it stops the rear wheels. And if you do that at 50 miles an hour, not a lot happens. But if you do it at 100 miles an hour, that front end drops so fast, like you almost start a front flip. So same thing, monster trucks can take off and they can actually do a double backflip because the wheel mass is 30% of the total mass of the vehicle. Where if you look at a bicycle or even a motorcycle, the wheel mass is 6% or something. So the more of the vehicle's mass that is in the wheels, the more you can do it. So if you look at an RC car, you can take off, jump it straight, hit the gas and do a double backflip and then stop it. Because obviously the tires proportionately are pretty heavy and they spin exponentially from anything that's real.
Because I've seen guys jumping motorcycles and like the front end's up a little too high or the back end's up a little too high and they literally adjust it in the air, which I never really thought about. But there's a fair bit of adjustment, not when you're doing a double backflip, I guess, but when you're just doing motocross, right?
Yeah, no, for sure. And that's, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't say this, but I like to ride the motocross track with my daughter. Always loves to go. We got little handlebars and foot pegs and stuff. And I was going over a small little jump, but I hit the rear brake. And she's like, "What just happened?" I was like, "Rear brake." She's like, "Oh." And I went over, hit the gas. So it's neat to have like a 5-year-old that's like, "Oh." So you hit the throttle and it comes up and hit the brake. So yeah, teaching that to my
Did
my
you say she's on the back of the bike?
Oh, no, the front. She's, never mind. Never happened. But yeah, hypothetically, some guy I knew.
Wow. You're so much better than my dad. So for you, racing. So would you say that you like competing and that competition could be with yourself if it needs to be, or it could be with other drivers, but either way, you just like that competition?
So I like racing with a checkered flag because it's not necessarily being better. It is simply bringing your competition down to your level, figuring out a way to equalize the playing field. And like in NASCAR, there is, if you're not cheating, you're not trying. Not they're cheating, but you look at the rule book and you say, okay, what hasn't been thought of? How can I get more downforce without breaking any of the rules that are officially written down? And I like that aspect. I like that aspect in all sport. And everyone's looking for that little competitive edge at the very top. Freestyle is different. And what's really neat about X Games is if you look at Tony Hawk's 900 back, 99 X Games, these guys have a chance. There's, $30,000 on the line for first place. Like these guys, no one's getting paid anytime outside of that in the year. Everyone has day jobs at this point in action sports. So like pretty much a full year's paycheck is going to come out of this one event. And even the guy that's currently leading that event after the time is yelling at X Games, no, keep it going. We want to see this guy land it. And it's about pushing the human spirit, pushing what's physically possible and what people think is impossible. And going beyond those boundaries. And that sounds a little deep for this, but at the end of the day, Tony Hawk landed that trick after time because all of his peers, instead of saying, "No, I want to win," said, "I want to see something be done tonight that has never been done before." And I feel like that's what separates most sport from freestyle or action sports, because it's not necessarily about winning, but it's about progression.
I like both. Have you ever been involved with or invited to or thought about doing any vintage racing?
Man, I break so many new bikes. I don't need to jump off. I have the Elsinore. I might go back. My dad
no,
had an
no.
Elsinore.
Vintage automobile, not the bike.
Oh, yeah. Dude, so I did the East African Safari Classic Rally, and that was amazing. Jumped in a old Porsche rear-wheel drive and went across basically center of Africa. And it's good because in rally, we usually have notes for every little bump. And I'm out there with Fabrizia, who's an amazing, iconic female rally co-driver. And we're going across, and she's like, "Yes, 20 miles, and then a sharp right." I'm like, "What, we do 20 miles?" And then she goes, "Elephant poop, elephant poop." And I'm like, "What? Like, okay, cool, there's elephant poop." And then we came over a crest to like 150, and there's elephants in the middle. She's like, "I told you elephant poop." I'm like, "You should have said slow down. There's elephants nearby."
Are you driving a vintage 911 in that race?
Vintage 911, yes.
Yeah, people. Oh, yeah, we're looking at it. Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah, people don't realize that they had a killer 959. I think it was Rothman's Porsche. They had some really cool rally 911s. Everyone always thinks of them as road racing cars, but they did a lot of those cars. Trying to think, like I have a lot of Datsun race cars. They had Baja 500 Z cars and Baja 500 510s and a lot of Paris to Dakar 911s and 959s. They had a lot of guys who did a lot of road racing, also had a lot of off-road stuff back then as well. Trying to think, like, because like Subaru does a lot of rally racing, but they're not doing any road racing, I don't think.
A little bit, like the 24-hour stuff, but not at that level of like Le Mans, where you're looking at the prototype class. But yeah, Subaru is, they're built for rally, all-wheel drive. I mean, super durable. Like they're the only car still that uses their actual frame, their actual motor, their everything. You're looking at a Volkswagen Bug, which nothing wrong with it, but when that thing's flying 0-60 in 1.8 seconds, you're like, wait a minute, what's in that Bug?
yeah, the one Tanner Faust is driving is not
exactly
not a stock. There's nothing stock about that. Yeah, 1984, a Porsche 959 Rally took both first and second in 1986. Porsche 959 won the Paris Dakar, first and second Paris Dakar Rally. Those cars, by the way, I think one of those sold for like $6 million or something the other day. Have you thought about doing Le Mans and or Daytona? 24 hours of Daytona, 12 hours of Sebring, an endurance, one of the big endurance races out here or there.
Yeah. Had a great opportunity to jump in with Kaufman and Michael Waltrip, and drove a Ferrari in 24 hours of Daytona. But for me, like as much as that is awesome, I'm better at making the best of the worst situations. I'm better when all four wheels are sideways on the dirt, figuring out how to keep the car on the road, where those guys, I mean, a 24-hour race has turned into a sprint race. These guys, every single lap is within a couple tenths of a second. They don't wear out the brakes. They're not hard on the cars. They don't ever overshoot a corner. The tires stay on the whole way. These are precision guys. I am not a precision driver. I am a Hail Mary, throw caution to the wind, and hopefully I have mechanics that can fix my car before the next stage.
Yeah, well, it's interesting.
Hey, there you go.
We're looking at you in a 488, I'm guessing, or 430. Maybe it's a 430. Trying to think of what you drove there. And did you drive a 430 or 488?
To be perfectly honest, I'm like Cole Trickle. They put me in the car to drive. And everyone, dude, every time I sit down at like a bar or something, every dude at the bar comes up and starts talking cars and dirt bikes. I'm like, dude, I'd love to drive. I know nothing about the mechanics of anything.
Sorry, 458. It was in between the 430 and the 488. And so I screwed that one up. The thing about the endurance racing, because I interviewed like the late great Dan Gurney about winning at Le Mans, and he would tell me that at the end of the Mulsanne straight, you couldn't just brake hard and downshift and turn. You had to make the brakes last, And so he started developing all these techniques, because half of it was, you had to drive the car, and then you also had to save the car. I mean, you couldn't brake the car. So you couldn't drive a 24-hour endurance race like a sprint race. The car would break back then. Now the technology is so good and the materials are so good that you can drive a 24-hour race like a sprint, which is pretty intense for 24 hours. So, yeah.
The guys are absolutely amazing. And I tell you, there's so many great race car drivers. Like every time I think, won a couple U.S. championships for rally, and every time I think, man, we're really on top of our game, some 60, 70-year-old dude comes out smoking a cigarette, like Stig Blomqvist, 1983 World Rally Champion back in the Group B days when they used to have so much horsepower. And my like second or third year rally, and he comes over to the U.S., late 60s at the time, doesn't do anything that an athlete you would think of does, and whooped our butts. And I'm just like, man, it's something that you lose probably last, is that feel of driving. So it's like motocross, except it's, you can do it for a really long time. So there's just so many amazing drivers. It comes down to the little details. Like NASCAR, it comes down to the crew chief and the driver and the homework that you put in along these things. Now, Dakar, I think, would be a really exciting rally, and it would be so much fun. But again, you can't overdrive. I have a hard time when you watch someone, like I did the Baja 1000 a few times, and someone will come flying by you, and you're like, oh, well, I got to keep up with him. But not really. You just have to keep up with the fastest guy that's not going to break his vehicle or crash. And in 1,000 miles or like, in the car, you're going for days. So it's really difficult to know how fast you have to go and to know what the opponents are doing. I mean, it's sometimes you're like, all right, well, we're right in the hunt. And then they'll just turn on a heater and you're like, shoot, we're 2 minutes down. Like, what do right. they do? And they had that much more in the tank. So distance racing has always been difficult for my kind of driving, for sure, or my kind of talent, if you will.
Are you able to, and I know exactly what you're talking about because I've done a couple of events with Jimmy Vassar, and that yes. guy would just show up, look hungover, have someone probably hold was. A cigarette, like go out, and he'd like, he had 10 laps to qualify. He'd do 2.5 laps and then just come in, get back out of the car and go grab a beer and start walking away. And then you're like, who's on the pole? Oh, Vassar's on the pole. He only did 2 laps. Yeah, that was fast enough for him. Like, it's crazy when the guys have that kind of casual talent or ability or something. But, and this is with
Vassar put in his time, years and years. And now he's just that good. But you look at so many of the guys that, you look at rally, even sport, but rally in the early 90s, late 80s, man, those guys used to go and they'd recce and they'd drink all night and they'd rally all day. And then it was all about the party, kind of like X Games in the late 90s. And now once money comes involved, you can't do that anymore. These guys, even NASCAR, they're fit. I mean, these guys are doing on their off days, they're doing triathlons and they're trying to get lightweight. There's an argument in Race of Champions, funniest conversation I've ever been a fly on the wall for. Race of Champions gets together the top like off-road and road driver from all over the world, from different countries to represent your country. So I was on with Kyle Busch, and the F1 champion at the time, Sebastian Vettel, was making fun of Kyle about his, you're not a real driver. Look at your gut. Right. And Kyle, who's a light guy in general, was like, what do you mean? He's like, look at your slippers. And Vettel, being very German, he's like, he thought it was a compliment. He's like, oh yes, they're like 0.003 ounces. Like these are right. great. And it was just so funny hearing the difference, because the F1 guys, every, like Petter Solberg won't even drive with a watch on, because that's going to take a half of a tenth of a second by the end of the rally or the end of the rally. So they're trying to cut down on all this weight and do everything, where the NASCAR guys are still kind of your good old boys, where they're like, I'm just going to outdrive you. Right. So it is cool to see the difference in culture and how much it is evolving now to every little ounce matters. And that's where F1 is already.
Well, it's funny you go back in the day and you see Mark Spitz, who was like the greatest Olympic swimmer of all time before Phelps. I think he won six gold medals. He's got a big bushy 70s porn mustache and like big 70s hair. And he's like, yeah, that's how I roll. And it's like now guys are shaving every fucking hair on their body just to try to get a little less drag, through the water. And it kind of reminds me of that. Like he had a big old bushy mustache. Nobody would do that with long hair and like chest hair and stuff. Like nobody would do that today.
No, you're slowing yourself down on purpose.
but the ladies love it. For you, are you able to shut it down, like as, and I don't know if you think of yourself as an adrenaline junkie, but are you able to just, watch some TV and have a beer and not be sort of have mind racing, thinking about the next conquest or the next project or the next adventure?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I tell you, if anything, COVID has been really good. I've never been able to take, rephrase, COVID has not been good, but it has been good for my family specifically, not financially or not business-wise or anything else. It's been really tough, obviously, on everyone. But I would have never been able to spend the last 3 months at home. I was planning on being on the road for 2 months. My family was going to try to come out in between school on the weekends to see me at the events. But even at the events, or when you're doing your shows or anything, you're still focused on other stuff, even though you're there together. I've had so much time to really spend with my family. And this has been a really kind of a wake up call to say, hey, look, you wouldn't have got this time back. And actually really excited. Actually started a project in Maryland, always wanted to be home more. You know, traveling's been amazing, especially for a single guy. It's great. But now with two young daughters, my wife, starting an area where, because my wife is a 2019 world champion for skateboards, and my kids like BMX and go-karts. So we're starting kind of a motorsports facility that's close by, and to also show off rally, to see, you know, to build a track that's like a hell track for back if you ever watched the movie Rad, where all these things are bigger and scarier and crazier, but also, you know, to build it as safe as we can. And now with the Olympics and everything, and my wife working with Women's Sports Foundation, to have a place where the kids have a chance to get into action sports and where we can do all that together.
Yeah, it's a good answer, because I was the same way. I was always traveling, always doing shows, always getting on a plane, and, you know, this sort of hustle, because you have a motor, and you kind of have this, you got to make that hay while the sun is shining kind of thing, and then it all gets shut down, and then you find yourself sort of hanging around and kind of enjoying your family. Like, it was like, oh, I don't know. But I think in a weird way, for guys like you and I, some force from the outside has to stop us. I don't know if you're going to do it internally. It has to be imposed on you, right?
That's what they said with motocross. When you say, oh yeah, I'm taking a break, meant you're broken, so you can't ride, so you're sitting at home.
Right, you took a break. The show, which is very excellent, by the way, which is coming on to Quibi this Monday, July 6th, Life-Size Toys. It's big. It's visually spectacular. And Travis, I'm always amazed and a little bit jealous on how good he is and how funny he is on camera. Most guys who wear a helmet for a living aren't so good in front of the camera, whether they're football players or rally drivers. But you are blessed in many different fields, my friend. So you have this sort of natural, affable likability and ease in front of the camera and funny. And also you can go out there and do what you do in the stunt department. So
this TV show was cool because we actually are on Quibi, I guess, TV kind of new right. format. Right. But we got to take a group of guys and Vicky Golden, who's one of the top female motocross racer female that ever qualified for an actual pro main event. But guys that are normally so scared doing what they're doing that they don't have a chance to get their personality across.
Mm-hmm.
And in this show, we had 2 weeks together just making fun of each other, having a blast. And it really felt like we were just big kids again, you know. And for us, yeah, it turned out to be a little more of a stunt show than a build show, which we had kind of started. But at the end, it was so much fun. And I think that camaraderie really came through. And you get to see the guys actually having fun and not feared for their life or doing, like, dropping it at X Games where their whole livelihood depends on it. So it's a good watch.
Yeah, it's a good watch. Life-Size Toys, Quibi, coming up Monday, July 6th. Thanks for joining us, Travis Pastrana. You know, I'm a huge fan. And hopefully when you're out in L.A. next, I can show you a bunch of race cars and hang out a little bit.
Hey, be careful what you ask for. I will take you up on that in a second. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Travis. Appreciate it. All right, let me hit live by live 4th of July mix. Oh, right. This weekend, putting together my personal 4th of July mix. Hours of great music for you to enjoy while you celebrate the nation's personal achievement day. There you go. Just go to Live by Live, that's livexlive.com, and search Adam, or download the Live by Live app. Again, search Adam Carolla and enjoy my personal curated 4th of July weekend music. And I mean it. I stand by those songs. All right. My book, I'm Your Emotional Support Animal. You can go ahead and get the audio and the Kindle. The hardback's coming soon, but check that out. Have a great 4th of July. Go to adamcarolla.com if you need any info, and go to our YouTube page as well. And until next time, Good Sports is coming up next. Adam Carolla for Gina Gradenball, Brian and Travis Pastrana saying mahalo.
Stick around. Dave Damashek and Adam Carolla come back next with Good Sports.
Shaky, let's do it. Good Sports. The Podcast One Sports Network presents Good Sports.
Hi and hello, sports fans, and welcome to the Friday edition of Good Sports. Dave Damashek here, Adam Carolla over there. A Tempe, Arizona visit on the ledger for Adam Carolla. What do you think about Sun Devils as a nickname, Ace? That's a pretty good one.
It's strong. It's going to be problematic at some point because everything's eventually going to be problematic. I'm starting to realize. So it'll have devil in it or sun with global warming and temperatures rising. You know, there's going to be
think about the sun.
Boy. There's going to be issues. So I
kind of redundant when you think about it. Devil in the sun. Yeah, that's where he would be, right? We don't need to say, wait, it's hot where the devil is. Yeah, we know. Like if it now hockey teams, the irony is all minor league hockey teams include ice in just about everything they do, whatever it is, mm-hmm. the ice Grizzlies, the ice Devils or whatever. Mm. The New Jersey Devils didn't do that. But in blazing hot Arizona, they felt compelled. Like it's not just the devil. It's one that's in the sun. Weird.
I think it's cheating to just add ice in front of whatever animal doesn't exist on the ice. You're not allowed to do that. Like you can't go the ice wallabies. You know what I mean? Like they don't live on the ice. They live in Australia. There's no ice. They live in the outback. You can't just put
wallabies.
Well, I'm saying you can't just put ice in front of something and make it into a hockey team. And by the way,
I agree. I hate it.
They don't do that with turf. You know what I mean? Like they don't take animals who like they don't go the turf polar bears, new soccer team. You know, they don't do that.
Yeah. NBA teams aren't like the Wood Devils.
They're right.
Like, yeah. Well, we don't need that. Yeah.
We
get it.
Pick a name that's good enough. And by the way, you don't have to justify it. I understand that Badgers don't play hockey. You know what I mean? Like I've wrapped my mind around that concept. Like if you want to name your junior hockey team the Badgers, I'm not going to go, wait a minute, are the Badgers playing or are these young boys? Oh, what's going on in the world?
You're right. I don't know why, but we've talked about that before. It makes me crazy in this age of every name changing. Still, among the most vexing for this nerdy sports fan and a guy who loved hockey growing up is that they got that the governors of the NHL put their heads together and they're like, we're not popular enough, gang. What can we do? You know what it is? It's our unique divisional names. Like, yeah, we're the Norris Division. It's off-putting to people. Like, what the math on that is fascinating to me about like dumbing it down. The lowest common denominator kind of application to everything makes me loco. You know, I don't know if you're aware of that, or you're an LA kid, but you know, like it was the Wales and the Campbell conferences. It wasn't the East and West. It was, you know, it was the Patrick Division. But it's meaningful now. It's like, oh, much more palatable now. It's just the Atlantic Division. Oh, great! Now I get it. Now
why
I
do we? I don't know where the Norris. I don't know where the names come from. I do. I remember the linebackers in football be like Mike, Stud, and Baker. You know, but I don't know why we needed handles. Couldn't we say inside, strong side, or weak side, or outside? What? I think people really, you know, people like they like specific talk. Doctors like it. Attorneys like it. I'm a woodworker. Woodworkers have all kinds of terms, and it kind of separates us from them or you, you know, and so anyone,
yes.
Real estate guys do that, you know, the sports guys love it and they love to talk real fast and then stop and explain to the little people, you know, like the unwashed masses, what it is they're talking about.
Oh, I mean, how about in comedy writing? The blow. Like, right. Wait, tell me about the blow. What does that mean?
Right.
All right. Settle down with your fancy. I agree with you, but then I completely agree with that. That it separates you from the unwashed. But then also, it's like those same people who enjoy dealing in that advanced jargon. Then the solution is, how do we make more people like it? We have to dumb it down. Well, you know, we're too
right.
smart for
everybody. Oh yeah, that's how you do it. You got to dumb it down. I do. Yeah. Not for you. You understand the meaning of everything you're talking about, but you got to dumb it down for everyone else in the nation. Yeah, I like that. Lawyers do it a lot. pilots do it a lot. You know what I mean? They don't say say gas. They go fuel. You know what I mean? They'd have little tells. Doctors, of course, do it a lot. I mean, if you hang around with Mark Garagos and Dr. Drew as much as I do, you will hear tons of that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Bill Barr, it seems to me he's on our TVs quite a bit. And I don't think he's ever gone four words into a sentence without including the word predicate. He loves saying that one. Is there a proper predicate? And I've never heard people use predicated and everything else as much as this guy has in the last couple of years in our collective lives of watching TV together.
Does Bill Barr, who looks, so whenever I see Bill Barr, I go, that guy looks like a 60-year-old who is 11 at the same time. Like he has that kid look, you know what I mean?
It's because he looks like, because he looks really like, I can't think of
that
the name
kid
of the movie.
That kid from the
your
movie.
Your pal.
Right,
your,
from the Christmas
well, no, your
movie.
Guy, no, I was going to say, oh, that's a great call, actually, from a Christmas movie. I was going to actually go with your pal who wrote it, and I feel bad I can't think of his name, but with the live bear, the teddy bear, Ted,
oh,
right?
Oh, you're talking about Seth MacFarlane.
Seth MacFarlane.
Yeah, he has that.
He looks like Ted is who he looks like.
Right.
He looks like the teddy bear.
So who are the guys who look, you know, there's just a thing. There's just a sort of man-child thing. There's just guys that look like when they're 60, they look like they're 11 years old. He always has that look to me. You know what I mean?
And it's what we've discussed before. It's really what you want. You know, like poor Sparky Anderson, when he was 39 years of age, he looked 54. But when he was 75, he still looked 54. He never changed. Once you reach a certain age, that's what you want. The long play. All right. Maybe if you go bald at 27, all right, not ideal, but people will think, oh, you still look the same as when we met 40 years ago, you know, when you're about to celebrate 70th birthday.
All right. So what do you got, Chick? Were you about to throw something out?
I was just going to ask you because a little win play show to bring home the week here. Win play show. Let's go is about as fundamental as we can go here. Shapes. I have some thoughts on it. I have some broad thoughts on it. I mean, like, just as red, blue, and yellow are the primary colors, mm-hmm. I feel that the primary three shapes are circle, square, triangle. And by the same, using the same dynamic, if there are two stars out of the three, and if there's the third wheel among the colors, it's definitely yellow. Mm-hmm. Like, everybody has red or blue. But yellow, nobody. You know, it's the third. It's in third place. Same thing with the triangle. And I don't know if it's fair. Like, it would definitely be. If everybody had to rank their favorite shapes, it would come down. Garrett just drew a picture of Bill Barr and what's his name from A Christmas Story. And it couldn't be more spot on. That's crazy.
That's him. Not
but
since.
I would say... Mm. But wouldn't you say circle and square, if the world weighed in on this, it would be one of those other. And the triangle gets short shrift. But, you know, I I think it deserves a shout out here, and I've just given it to it. Your favorite shape, Ace.
I'm a rectangle and or oblong kind of guy.
Look who's playing a wild card. He's writing in. He's writing the name in there.
I'm picturing... You know, the shape of a football field, of a basketball court, of a tennis court, you know, soccer, like all, most all are played on that shape. I don't know. Is an oblong another name for rectangle?
An oval?
Or is it different?
I think oblong, oval is what comes to my mind, but let me investigate.
No, look up oblong.
An
That's
imperfect
old school.
Square. It's also, you know, I hadn't really thought about this now, but now I am. I think if you choose circle, it sort of says that you're an individualist. Why? Mm-hmm. Because you don't lean on anybody else except yourself. It's one complete circle by an individual versus a square requires four parts equal of the exact same length and not a whisker more or less coming together to form a perfect shape.
So an oblong, I'm going oblong because this is the Swiss Army knife of names and shapes because it's elongated. It's a rectangle or oval shape. And I love, is that what it is? I love a football field, and I love the Indy 500 as well. That's oblong. They both fall under the umbrella of oblong.
Oblong Adam Carolla and square Dave Damashek, completing another successful week of hot sports talk here for you. Ace, have a good time in the Valley of the Sun, and we'll be back with some more hot sports talk for you next week. Until then, for Adam Carolla, Dave Damashek, good sports out. Good sports.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow us on Twitter at Adam Carolla. Leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744. Pick up Adam's new book, I'm Your Emotional Support Animal. It's available everywhere. Click the link at adamcarolla.com.
And before we get out of here, one more thanks to Geico. Do you own? Do you rent? What do you do? Do you want a bundle? Well, you own or you rent, or you got to have insurance. You got to have auto insurance. Bundle it. Make it easy. Save money. Let's get it under one roof at Geico. At geico.com, get a quote. See just how much you could be saving on your homeowners and your rental insurance when you bundle. That's Geico, geico.com.